As we turn to Genesis chapter 37, we begin the final sprint through the end of the book of Genesis. Actually, the story of Joseph moves along much more rapidly than does any other comparable length passage in the book of Genesis. It's a running narrative interrupted only briefly by chapter 38, the story of Judah's sons. But the story rolls along quite smoothly and often requiring very little comment. I will, however, comment that Joseph has often been seen as a type of Christ. The New Testament does not identify Joseph as a type of Christ, so he might not be one. We don't know for sure, but certainly there are a lot of ways in which Joseph's story appears to place him in the role of a type of Christ himself. In fact, one commentator I once consulted had something like 35 points of correspondence between the story of Joseph and the life of Jesus himself. And I will observe some of these, not all of them, as we go through. But let's start at chapter 37. Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the genealogy of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now, apparently, there were bad things these boys were doing. We don't know what they were doing. They might have been consorting with the local women of the villagers around them, or they might have been careless with the sheep. They might have been wasteful. They might have been telling bad stories. They might have been showing disrespect to their father in the way that they spoke. We don't know what they were doing. All we know is that Joseph was a tattletale. He came home and told his father what these boys were doing and got them in trouble with their father. Now, generally speaking, we consider tattletales to be not good. In fact, parents often teach their children not to be tattletales. Although I'm not sure where the value that informs that ethic arose from. I'm not sure why it is thought that if a child is aware of wrongdoing, he shouldn't tell his parents about it. I think that it comes from our own sinful nature that we all resent somebody who informs on us when we do wrong, and therefore we think they must be a very bad person because they're not minding their own business and leaving us to our sin to go unchallenged. But I really don't know of any biblical value or ethic that would say it's wrong to tell when somebody is doing wrong. We know, of course, of a case where 40 men conspired to kill Paul. Fortunately, Paul's nephew overheard it and brought news of it to the governor and or the captain of the guard and got Paul delivered out of their hands for it. If he had decided not to be a tattletale, it would have probably not gone as well for Paul. I don't know of any place in the Bible that indicates that to bear a true report of evil against a wrongdoer to the proper authorities, that this is a wrong thing to do. Now, of course, gossip is another thing. And gossip, by definition, would be where you convey negative information about a person who is not present at the time that you're gossiping to a person who maybe doesn't have any business knowing. One friend of mine, a preacher, said that he thinks gossip, which is, by the way, very hard to define because slander and gossip and an evil report and just telling the truth about somebody who's got something bad to say about them, those things are kind of areas, the boundaries between which are rather hazy. But one preacher friend of mine, I thought, gave a reasonably good definition of gossip as speaking about somebody negatively to a person who is neither part of the problem nor part of a solution. In other words, the person you're talking to doesn't have anything to do with it. It's just, you know, passing along a bad rumor about somebody, which may or may not be true, but passing it along to somebody who has got no business knowing, because they are neither a person contributing to the problem and therefore not needing to repent and fix it, nor are they a person who has any contribution to make to the solution to the problem. In the case, though, of brothers who are misbehaving, and one of the brothers bringing a report back to the father, that certainly is not gossip. The father is in the position to control and discipline his sons. And I'm sure that by bringing the evil report to the father, Joseph earned himself a lot of resentment from his brothers, as those who tattle or who think or whatever, who are narc today on their on the wrongdoing of others, usually are very much despised, possibly even despised more than the authorities to whom they narc are despised. I mean, I think that if somebody blows the whistle to the federal government about some wrongdoing in some major corporation, the major corporation probably resents the whistleblower more than he resents the federal government who comes in and cracks down on him. There's just something about being a tattletale that is considered to be really not okay. But biblically, there's nothing wrong with bearing a report to the proper authorities of things that are being done wrong by someone else. And if more people were willing to brave the resentment of those upon whom they inform, we might have less criminal and corrupt things going on in government and in corporations today and in families as well. But no one wants to be a tattletale. And yet Joseph went ahead and did it. Of course, he was hated by his brothers because of that. But he knew that his father deserved to know what was happening behind his back from his own sons. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. And it doesn't mention it, but he was also the son of Rachel, the only wife that Jacob ever loved. Probably had something to do with it. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. And when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now, it doesn't take long for siblings to notice favoritism shown to one child. Jacob should have known better than to do this. He came from a home where there had been favoritism. His brother Esau was favored by his father, and he himself was favored by his mother. He should have vowed that he'd never do the same thing with his children, but he didn't, and he had a favorite. He showed favorites. He might have even done so deliberately and flagrantly out of resentment toward his other sons. Remember, Jacob never really wanted to marry anyone but Rachel. Joseph and Benjamin were the only children he had from Rachel. Benjamin was probably a baby at this time. And that being so, he may have even resented his other sons, especially after they were grown and troublemakers. He may have kind of wished they'd never existed. He never really wanted their mothers to be his mates anyway, and so he may have been just favoring Joseph in such a way as to rub salt in their wounds or find some way to get back at them for the grief they had brought to him. We don't know what. I don't know if Jacob was just plain stupid in showing favoritism or if he was doing it on purpose, but it seems rather stupid because he gave Joseph a coat of many colors, which was most scholars feel this was an indication that not only did he favor Joseph, but that this was something like a royal garment, and that it was something that suggested that he intended the birthright to go to Joseph. Now, it would not be surprising if Jacob wished to give the birthright to Joseph, because Joseph was the firstborn of Rachel, and Rachel's the only wife Jacob ever wanted. And although there were 10 brothers older than Joseph, Jacob didn't necessarily want to acknowledge their prior claim to the birthright, since they were all, you know, not the boys he wanted. Joseph was, and so he may have been, as I say, deliberately trying to show the other brothers that Joseph was the one that was going to be favored with honor in the family as the firstborn when the inheritance was to be divvied up. But this only made the brothers, of course, more jealous. The father should have known that these men were capable of murder. After all, Simeon and Levi had wiped out a whole city. Jacob was rather stupid to rub this favoritism in the wounds of an already resentful older brothers. But he did so anyway. It seems almost like criminal stupidity on his part, because it endangered Joseph unfairly. And it says already, even before he was in physical danger, they hated him and couldn't speak peaceably to him. So there's no peace in the home. Every time they spoke to Joseph, it was with a cutting remark or an edge on the remark that made it very clear they were hostile toward him. Now, Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. Now, in this narrative, we're going to find from time to time a story or a part of the story is summarized in a single verse, and then it is unpacked. I think this is one of those cases. Verse 5 summarizes the material that is unpacked in verses 6 through 8. In other words, you could leave out verse 5 and get as much information because it simply summarizes what we're about to be told. Verses 6 through 8 give the details of what is stated in verse 5. Joseph dreamed a dream and he told it to his brothers and they hated him even more. That's a summary. Here's what happened. So he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." And his brothers said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Now, Joseph was not very tactful, apparently. I mean, he knew they were jealous already. Some people might think that he himself was trying to boast and trying to lord himself over them by telling these dreams. It is possible. After all, he was only a teenager, and he wasn't all that wise, and he might not have been all that humble. We don't know. But there's nothing intrinsically wrong with him sharing the dream. It just may not be very wise. Perhaps he should have told it to his father, or just as Mary, when Mary bore Jesus, shepherds came and told her what the angels had said about her son and all these wonderful things about her son, but she didn't go around and boasting about it to all the other Jewish mothers. "Hey, you should hear what my son's going to be. You should hear what these people said. Angels came and talked about my son. What do you think about that?" I mean, that would make the other Jewish mothers maybe resentful. What it says of Mary is that when she heard these things, she pondered them in her heart. She didn't say anything about it. She just pondered it. It's rather hard to do when you're flattered. Hard not to go out and drop names and tell of all the things that show how wonderful you are or your children or whatever. But there's times when that's the appropriate thing to do. Joseph should have wisely kept it to himself. God was obviously showing him something about his destiny. His brothers would someday bow down to him, just like their sheaves in his dream bowed down to his sheaf. Verse 9, then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I've dreamed another dream. And this time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowed down to me." So he told it to his father and his brothers. And his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come and bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in his heart. Now see, like Mary kept things in her heart, Jacob, after his initial sort of offended reaction, kept it in his heart, like he thought, maybe there is something to this. But the brothers didn't even consider the possibility that these dreams were anything that should be seen as a revelation from God, or if they were, that they were not going to submit to it. They envied him, but his father kept these things in his mind. The sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowing down to him, his father understands this to mean that his father and his mother and his 11 brothers will bow down to him. Now, I don't know how his mother could bow down to him since she was dead, unless the chronology has been reported out of order, but it would appear that his mother was not living at this time, and therefore, how could she bow down to him? Maybe since the sun and the moon and the stars are, in fact, heavenly bodies, perhaps Jacob understood this to refer to some exalted position in the next life, you know, in heaven or something, that Jacob and Rachel and the 11 sons of Jacob would bow down to Joseph. It's not clear exactly how he understood this, except that he did identify the sun, moon, and 11 stars with his own family, the house of Israel. Later on in Revelation chapter 12, a woman is seen clothed in the sun with the moon at her feet and on her head a garland of 12 stars. You've got the sun and the moon and the 12 stars associated with this woman in Revelation 12, and almost all commentators have not failed to recognize this connects her with Israel, because here we have the sun, moon, and the 11 stars. Joseph would be the 12. The 11 stars are bound down to him. And in Revelation, it's the sun and the moon and the 12 stars associated with the woman. She apparently is a symbol of Israel. And the imagery is taken from this story. Now, verse 12, then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. This is the same area where Simeon and Levi had wiped out the whole city previously. Shechem either was a ghost town now, or had been, the buildings had perhaps been moved into by other nomadic people who had now occupied it. But this is that region where they would be very poorly regarded by the locals. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." So he said to him, "Here I am." And he said to him, "Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me." So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. Now this is very, very strange. Certainly Jacob must not have been ignorant of the jealousy toward Joseph that his other sons nursed. And he was not unaware of, even in that same place, Shechem, two of those sons had killed a whole bunch of people that they hated for very little provocation. And he sends Joseph on a journey of, as it turns out, about 50 miles from the valley of Hebron to Shechem. It's about a 50-mile journey. It's going to take him a couple or 3 days to get there. And he's even wearing his coat of many colors, the thing that just causes his brothers to see red. And they only see one color when they see that coat. And it makes them angry, and they're jealous of it. And here Joseph is sent on this dangerous journey to be left at the mercy of his brothers, who hate him, who are murderous men themselves, and he's wearing his coat, the thing that's only calculated to in anger them more. It seems really stupid. No, it's very hard to know why Jacob made a decision like this. He could have sent a servant to bring back a message, obviously. He apparently feels that his sons would never go so far as to hurt Joseph, and perhaps he just wants to irk them to the almost to the breaking point. He apparently wants to rub salt in their wounds by sticking Joseph in their face, as it were, and the evidence of his favoritism toward Joseph to be paraded in front of them. He apparently did not figure on exactly how far the anger of his brothers would incline them to go. Now, a certain man found Joseph, and there he was wandering in the field. Apparently he got lost. And the man asked him, saying, "What are you seeking?" So he said, "I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks." And the man said, "They have departed from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. Dothan is the place where, of course, his brothers captured him and sold him into slavery. At a later date in Israel's history, Dothan was a city where Elisha and his servant were staying in the 6th chapter of 2 Kings, where the Syrians sought to capture Elisha. They surrounded the city. So Joseph and Elisha, both in this same spot at different times in history, were surrounded and outnumbered by their enemies. However, in the days of Elisha, Elisha was not afraid. His servant was, but Elisha prayed for his servant's eyes to be opened so he could see what was really going on. And 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 13 through 17, we find that God opened the eyes of Elisha's servant, and he saw on the hillside all around Dothan chariots of fire, angelic protective armies there, protecting Elisha. We might ask, where were those armies at this time, when in the same town Joseph fell prey to his brothers? Well, the angels were there. The angel of the Lord encamps round about them that fear him and delivers him, it says in the proverb, in Psalm 34:7 or 34:8. And that being so, we have to assume that the angels of God were present and could have delivered Joseph from his brother's hands, just as they, at a later date, in the same location, delivered Elisha from the armies of the Syrians. But why didn't they? It's interesting that at the end of his life, Joseph recognized that God is the one who delivered him into his brother's hands and had him sold into slavery. He didn't understand that initially. But at the end of his life, he said to them, or at the end of their lives or whatever, he said to them, "You," referring to this event, "you intended evil against me, but God meant it for good." He saw that even though his brothers had no good intentions, God allowed him to fall into their hands because God had good intentions. But those good intentions were going to take Joseph through a great amount of suffering first, before Joseph would be very well rewarded and vindicated in the mercy of God later on. This, of course, simply is to remind us that even when we fall prey to other people's hostility, crimes done against us by other people. God could have prevented it. God's angels are around. If God allows us to suffer at the hands of others, we cannot assume that it wasn't the will of God. Just because the others were doing something wrong doesn't mean that God didn't want us to go through this experience. He could have prevented it. Jesus, of course, of whom Joseph may be a type, was betrayed by his brethren also, not in the same spot, not in Dothan, but in the Garden of Gethsemane. But at that point, he said to Peter, "Do you not know that if I wished, I could call 12 legions of angels, and they would come and defend me right now?" There were no doubt 12 legions of angels there in Dothan at this time who could have delivered Joseph, but it was not Jesus. Jesus didn't call for the angels, and Joseph probably didn't know that they were around, and it was not at that point God's will for him to be delivered, any more than it was God's will for Jesus to be delivered. Jesus did not call on the angels, and the angels did not rescue him. Nor did the angels on this occasion rescue Joseph. Now, when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. We know they saw his coat of many colors. It doesn't say so here, but it was on him. We know because they took it off him in verse 23. So even before his clothes, they recognized him by his clothing, the bright, gaudy, royal-like garment that he was wearing. He was way far off, but they saw who it was, and they couldn't mistake him. And they started desiring to find a way to kill him, and if they could get away with it. And they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say, some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams." In other words, they wanted to kill him so that he would never rule over them. They were very mindful of the dreams, of the prophecies, that they would serve him someday, that he would be their ruler. And they said, "Oh yeah, over my dead body, we'll see how these dreams materialize after we kill him." It's so similar to the reaction of the Jews in Jesus' day. Recognizing Jesus as God's appointed Messiah to rule over them, but not wanting to. Remember the parable Jesus told of the vineyard, which was Israel, and the tenants of the vineyard, who were the Jewish leaders. And they killed all the servants that the master sent, and finally he sent his son, saying, "They'll surely reverence my son." But remember what they said? They said, "This is the heir. Let us kill him, and his inheritance will be ours." Jesus said that that's what the Jewish leaders were thinking when they saw him. They said, "This is the Son of God. This is the heir. If we let him live, he will rule over us. But we don't want that, so let's kill him, and then we'll see what happens to these dreams. We'll see if this man will rule over us." They kill him so that he will not rule over them. Yet Joseph, as it were, emerged from the pit alive and eventually ruled over them, just as Jesus emerged from the grave alive and rules over the whole world, including the Jews who killed him. Well, this is the way Joseph's brothers reacted. Verse 21, but Reuben was an exception. When he heard it, he delivered him out of their hands and said, "Let us not kill him." Now, verse 21 is another case that summarizes what is said in more detail. Verse 22 tells us the same thing as verse 21. It's just verse 21 summarizes it, and verse 22 gives more detail. Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father." Now, he did not let his brothers know that he intended to save Joseph. Reuben, though he was the oldest, was greatly outnumbered by his brothers, and it was not a safe thing in their present state of mind for him to stand in opposition to them. He might endure the same fate as Joseph. Now, what they were suggesting was kill him and throw his corpse into a pit. And Reuben says, "Listen, I don't think we should lay our hands on him. Just put him in the pit alive. You know, the assumption is he'll starve there. He'll die. We won't have to have his blood on our hands. I mean, we don't have to actually do the act of violence of killing the man and getting his blood on us. Why don't we just put him in the pit without killing him? And, you know, he can't get out of there. He'll die. We'll accomplish the same purpose, and we'll avoid having slain our brother quite so directly." Of course, in real life, in real morals and ethics, that wouldn't be any less guilty if you put a man in a position where you're guaranteed he'll starve to death, or if you kill him with an act of violence yourself, you're equally guilty. These men were not, however, highly sophisticated in the area of morals. And they therefore thought, well, okay, yeah, I guess we wouldn't be quite as guilty if we did that. So they agreed with what Reuben said, not knowing that Reuben did that, hoping that when perhaps they were asleep or some other time, he could come back after they'd moved their flocks onto another place. He could come back and get Joseph out, short of Joseph dying, and deliver him to his father. What's remarkable is that Reuben was the oldest and the one who had the most to lose, it would seem, by Joseph surviving. Because if his father intended to give the birthright to Joseph, it is Reuben who ostensibly would be the one who would receive it if Joseph didn't get it. Reuben is the one who stood naturally in line for the birthright, and yet he had, though he didn't have very good morals in the sense that he slept with his father's concubine, yet he did have a bit of a conscience when it came to killing his brother, and he was more willing to endanger his own birthright than he would be willing to kill his brother in order to secure it for himself. So that's to a certain degree commendable, though Reuben was not fully commendable. He didn't stand up boldly to his brothers and take his fate on himself and say, well, listen, you guys are sinners and this is wrong. Killing our brother is absolutely wrong, and you'll have to take me down too if you're going to do it to him. But Reuben, in a weak sort of a way, did take the side of right. Verse 23, so it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. This was apparently one of the many wells that had been dug but had been used up. Water is very rare in the desert, and people would dig wells just deep enough to get enough water to feed their sheep and their bodies, and then eventually they'd use up the supply that was there. Probably they could get more if they dug deeper, but instead of doing that, they just move on somewhere else in many cases. Or maybe there wasn't any. Maybe they couldn't dig deeper and find more. Maybe there was just a little pocket of water there, and they used it up, and the well was dry. The wells were dug in those days with a narrower top than bottom. That is, they kind of opened up at the bottom in the shape of a beaker. They're wide at the bottom, narrow at the top, so that the walls of them sloped inward as you go upward, which means it'd be very difficult or impossible to climb the walls. It'd be much different, of course, if they were strictly perpendicular. But you'd have to be able to hang on upside down like a fly on the ceiling to climb out of one of those things. And it was not uncommon in that part of the world, even during wars, when captives were taken. And they wanted to keep the captives alive, but they didn't want them to escape. They'd put them into these dry pits that happened to be around where people had used up the water out of wells. Jeremiah himself was put into one of these, only it wasn't quite dry, and it was muddy. He was in the mire and the mud. But pits like that were not unusual places for incarceration or for temporary captives to be kept. And it was almost impossible to get out once you put in. It was quite deep, and the walls being shaped the way they were, you couldn't really climb out. There's no water in this pit. Which means he'd die of thirst, if not of hunger, in a few days at the most. And they sat down to eat a meal. So this is how callous they were. It didn't even ruin their appetite, the thought of letting their brother starve to death and be a few days later perhaps just bones. And they sat there eating. And then they lifted up their eyes and looked, and there were a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices, balm, and myrrh, on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brothers listened. Then the Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. That meant these brothers would get 2 shekels each since there were 10 brothers. Benjamin was not among them. And they took Joseph to Egypt. Judah is the one who speaks up this time. And we don't know really what motivated Judah. Ostensibly his motive was like that of Hamor and Shechem appealing to the men of Shechem to circumcise themselves. There's a profit motive here. Although Hamor and Shechem had a different motive for wanting the people to circumcise themselves. And it may be that Judah had a different motive also. He may have been appealing to these people in an area where he knew they'd be affected, money. You know, listen, if we just leave our brother here to die, Well, we'll be rid of our brother. That's a good thing. But, you know, we could be rid of him and make some money on him, too, if we sold him to this nomadic group of Midianites coming by, and they're going down to Egypt. We can just sell him as a slave, make a bit of money. And then we kill two birds with one stone. We get our brother out of our hair, and we also get a little money in our pockets. Now, Judah may have been motivated by nothing more than what appears to be the case. He may have been just a monetary motivation. But later on, we find, in fact, in the very next chapter, Judah separates himself from his brothers. It doesn't say why, but it may be that he was disgusted by his brothers because of the selling of Joseph into slavery. In chapter 38, verse 1, it says, "It came to pass at that time that Judah departed from his brothers, and he relocated and started a family somewhere else." He didn't stay with the family. And he may have been of a different mind than his brothers. At a later date, he rejoined his family in the famine. And he himself is the one who shines brightest as the most virtuous of the remaining brothers, other than Joseph, in that when there is a danger to Benjamin, Judah, as we see in the end of the book, actually offers to himself be a slave for life in Egypt in order that Benjamin might be restored to his father. And we see Judah actually a man of a very different temperament than his brothers in that later story. So we see that in this story, probably Judah was doing the same kind of thing Reuben was. He didn't know what Reuben's plan was. Reuben actually planned to come rescue him out of the pit and send him home. Judah didn't know about that. And by the way, Reuben was not here at the moment when this negotiation was taking place. We can see that in verse 29. When Reuben returned to the pit, indeed Joseph was not in the pit. And he tore his clothes. And he returned to his brothers and said, "The lad is no more, and I, where shall I go?" He didn't know what had happened. The transaction, the sale of Joseph, happened while Reuben was gone. Where he was, I don't know. But they had big flocks. They probably had to be stationed in various positions in the flock to make sure the flock was safe. But Reuben had his own plan to rescue Joseph, but no one else knew about it, which means Judah didn't know about it. And in Reuben's absence, Judah came up with his own plan to save Joseph's life. And that was, well, at least if we sold him to slavery, we wouldn't kill him. And he persuaded his brothers to do that. And that prevented Reuben from actually being able to rescue him as he'd planned to do. Things happened beyond his control. And so Joseph was in Egypt, or taken down to Egypt by these people. Now, Reuben returned, as we pointed out in verse 29 and 30. And he said, "The lad is no more. Where shall I go?" It's hard to know exactly what that means. It might mean, how can I go home to my father and tell him this news? I'd rather go anywhere else than that. Knowing how much Jacob loved Joseph and how hard Jacob would take it to hear this. Or even, possibly, because Reuben, being the oldest, would have to bear the responsibility for the brothers' corporate actions, since he was essentially the oldest and ostensibly the one who had the right of birthright that had not been officially designated to Joseph yet. And therefore, the actions of the brothers might fall more heavily on Reuben because of it, and he didn't know if he could stand to go home, knowing what had happened. It's not even clear that Reuben knew what had happened. It says, "The lad is no more." That would be an ordinary way of saying he's dead. And yet he must have found out that he'd been sold into slavery. Verse 31, "So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dip the tunic in the blood." That wouldn't get past the modern crime labs that do DNA testing on blood and so forth to find out if that's the blood of the victim or the blood of the murderer or what. But it worked in those days before biochemistry and microscopes and things like that. They could actually put animal blood on the robe and have it mistaken for humans. "Then they sent the tunic of many colors and they brought it to their father and said, 'We have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not?' And he recognized it and said, 'It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn in pieces.'" Now, the brothers apparently didn't personally bring this. It says they sent the tunic and brought it to him. Apparently, it means through a servant they brought it to him. They sent it by the hands of servants. That would be a lot easier for them to have to face him and have to try to tell this lie without wincing, without looking away and so forth. And without their lie being found out, just send a servant who doesn't know any better and let the servant say, "Your brothers have sent this, your sons have sent this, they found it, wondered if this is Joseph's or not." Now, it's interesting that the sons of Jacob slew a goat kid and deceived their father by doing so. Jacob himself had deceived his father with the skins of a goat kid and with the meat of a goat kid that he had prepared and impersonated his brother Esau. It's interesting how what goes around comes around. Here, the man himself, having deceived his father, even with the use of a goat kid, ends up being deceived by his sons by the use of a goat kid as well. Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and he mourned for his son for many days. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, the hypocrites, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "For I shall go down to the grave to my son in mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Now the Midianites had sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and a captain of the guard. We will see that same information repeated in chapter 39, verse 1, in order to pick up the thread of the story again at that point. However, parenthetically, we have chapter 38, which tells us something of Judah and very probably of his reaction to all of this. It says, "It came to pass at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira." Adullam, the region that he went to, is a region that at a later time, it's in southern Judah in the wilderness. Later on, David hid in the caves of Adullam. In fact, it was there that Saul entered the cave and David had an opportunity to kill him, but didn't. That was in the caves of this same region of Adullam. It was in the region of Judah's tribe later on, but Judah, the man himself, went down to that region, stayed with a guy named Hira, and he was an Adullamite, and Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he married her and went into her. So she conceived and bore a son and called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son and called his name Onan, and she conceived yet again and bore a son and called his name Shelah, he was at Chizib when she bore him. So he didn't stay in the same place. By the time his third son was born, he was relocated. Then Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. Now Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. And Judah said to Onan, "Go in to your brother's wife and marry her, and raise up an heir to your brother." But Onan knew that the heir would not be his. And it came to pass when he went into his brother's wife that he emitted on the ground, lest he should give an heir to his brother. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord, therefore he killed him too. Let's stop there for a minute. There's two sons in a row got married this girl and both died. We are not told what it was that was so wicked about Ur, the firstborn, that he died. But he must have been exceptionally bad. God killed him. Now, this might just be, seeing the sovereignty of God behind some accident that befell him. Maybe he fell off his camel and hit his head against a rock and died. And they say, well, that was God's judgment on him because he was such a wicked man. And it could be true. That would be entirely possible. He may have died of sickness, or he might have died in some mysterious cause in his sleep. In any case, it was understood by those of a later date that this was a judgment from God on him for his wickedness. And therefore, Judah said, well, hey, he died without a child. His name is going to be blotted out from history unless some child is born for him. And so he said to the next brother, Onan, go in and marry this woman and raise up an heir for your brother. Now, this later became law in Israel. Moses' law had what was called the law of Levirate marriage. Of course, Moses was not around yet when this story occurred, and therefore... It suggests that the law of Levirate marriage actually encoded a tradition of the times also. That is, there was a sense of conscience about this matter, even among the Middle Eastern peoples, or at least God's people, before the law was given that actually codified it. And that was that if a man died without a male heir, that means that he was blotted out from history. If he had any inheritance, it went into no man's land. It went into the twilight zone. What was more desirable is that a man could leave his inheritance and his name through a son who would perpetuate it through sons who would perpetuate it through sons and so forth. His name would be continued. But if a man died childless later in law, and apparently in the common conscience of the people at the time of Judah, his brother could marry the widow, and the first child of that marriage would belong and be named after the brother who died. So that if Onan had had children by Tamar, the first son would have been named after Ur, would have actually carried on Ur's inheritance, although he wasn't Ur's son. But he was as close as you could get because he was born to Ur's wife, the same woman who would have borne him if he were Ur's son. So, I mean, he had the same mother but a different father. And that made him kind of a half-son of Ur, I guess. That is how they reasoned. Now, in such a case, if Onan had had two sons by Tamar, only the first would carry on the name of the deceased. The second would be part of Onan's own family. But Onan may have had other wives already. This was a law in the days of Moses that even if a man had a wife already and his older brother died childless, he should take the widow of his older brother and marry her too. I mean, he'd have two wives then. He might sleep with her no more after she bore one son for the deceased brother's name to be carried on, or he might just keep her in his harem and have more sons of his own. But the point was, the point of taking the brother-in-law's wife, I mean the brother's wife, of the woman marrying her brother-in-law, as it were, which is what levirate marriage means, comes from the word lever, which means brother-in-law. For the woman to marry her brother-in-law when her husband dies was the idea to perpetuate the name of the deceased. Now, Onan, we don't know anything about how wicked he was prior to this. We don't even know how or in what ways Ur was wicked or how God killed him. But God ended up killing Onan also because Onan would not cooperate. Onan was apparently forced by social custom to marry the girl, but he would not copulate with her. He would not allow her to conceive because he knew the heir would be his brother's. Now, why would that stop a man? I mean, sure, he might wish that all the sons born of his seed would be his sons, but it doesn't cost him anything. He must have had an extraordinary degree of hostility toward his deceased brother. There must have been no love between them. And he must have seen it as one way he could get back at his brother is to prevent him from having a seed to carry on his name. And this attitude toward his brother must be principally what God despised in Onan, and he killed him too. Now, what Onan actually did was practice the only known case in the Bible of birth control. And it's a method of birth control still obviously practiced today as well. Nowadays we have all kinds of high-tech methods of birth control if people don't want to conceive, but in those days, one of the few ways was abstinence, and another was withdrawal, as we call it today, and that's what he practiced. He did not avoid having intimate time with her, but he did avoid allowing his seed to intermix with her eggs, and he did not allow there to be a child conceived. And for this, he was killed. Now, some people, especially people who take a strong stand against birth control, have felt like this is a place in the Bible that shows that God despises birth control. Here, the only man in the Bible who is recorded to have practiced it, of course, others probably practiced it, we don't have everybody's sex life recorded in Scripture, but the only case we know on record of someone practicing birth control, God kills the guy for doing it. And this is thought to perhaps speak very plainly about God's hatred for birth control. I don't know whether God hates birth control. My own position is that birth control is absolutely unnecessary to the Christian, since the Christian believes several things. One is that marriage is for fruitfulness, since that's what God created marriage for. Secondly, that lots of children are a blessing rather than a curse, and the more that a man has, the more blessed he is, according to Scripture, Psalm 127. And a third thing that the Christian teaches is that God's the one who controls when babies are conceived and or prevents it. God opens the womb or closes it. Therefore, in view of God's sovereignty in the matter and the desirability of having many children, a person who practices birth control must not believe some of those things. There must be one or more of those things that the Bible teaches that is not believed by the Christian who practices birth control. Either the Christian thinks they have to do so because God's not really sovereign and they have to take charge of this matter, and that if they don't use birth control, they're guaranteed to have babies, even if God doesn't want them to, they suspect. Or else they're rebelling against the number that God wants them to have, or they don't agree with God that having a lot is a blessing. I mean, there's some area of disagreement with God. But at the same time, the use of birth control is nowhere in the Scripture called a sin. And we cannot say necessarily that God wants to kill everybody who ever uses birth control, regardless of their motives. This person had a particularly bad motive for trying to prevent conception. God's opinion about birth control in other situations must be judged on other bases than this story. But the principal thing here was this man was not willing to cooperate with the social and presumably moral obligation to help his brother be perpetuated through seed. And he must have had an unusual degree of antagonism toward his brother, because most men would go ahead and finish out the act, even regardless whose baby it was going to be. I mean, especially when if he had a second. But he just didn't want to give his brother any favors at all. And so he didn't avoid having sex with her, but he did avoid consummating with her. So the thing displeased the Lord, therefore he killed him also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, "Remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah is grown." For he said secretly in his heart, "Lest he also die as his brothers did." In other words, Judah didn't quite understand what was going on here. He knew that two of his sons had married this woman and had both had died. He did not know what we know, namely that God had slain those men because of their wickedness. All that Judah could see is that two men had married her and died prematurely. For all he knew, there might be a curse on this woman. I mean, his own superstition might have thought, well, boy, I don't want Shelah to die too by marrying her. Obviously, it wasn't marriage to this woman that killed the first or second son. It was their own wickedness. But Judah is thinking that marriage to her might be what did it, and he doesn't want to endanger Shelah by having him marry her too. Obviously, if Shelah was a wicked man, God could slay him whether he married Tamar or not. And if he was a righteous man, he could marry Tamar and not suffer such consequences. But Judah apparently was thinking that the curse affixed to the woman herself rather than to the wickedness of the brothers. So he wrongly withheld Shelah from her. Now, she saw this, and all society saw this, as a wrong done to her, because she deserved to have a child. If there was still a son, if there was still a brother-in-law of hers living who could conceive or who could impregnate her, then she had the right to become a mother. And so this was wrong for Judah to withhold his son from her. Now, in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. So now Judah was a widower. And Judah was comforted. That simply means he went through the stage of mourning and had come to the point where he was no longer mourning. And he went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. And it was told Tamar, saying, "Look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she took off her widow's garments, which were black garments in color, and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself. And she, as it turns out, dressed up like a harlot would dress, with a veil over her face so that her customers would not ever know what she looked like. Apparently, those who consorted with harlots didn't care what they looked like because they never really saw their faces. They were in that society, they covered their faces. And sat in an open place. I guess that would make prostitution open to a larger number of women than in our society, I suppose. Because in our society, there are women who would never get any customers. But if you covered the whole body and the face, I guess anyone could be a harlot. And sort of a affirmative action, sort of a arrangement for equal access to the profession. Well, she covered herself and sat in an open place which was on the way to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown and she was not given to him as a wife. And when Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot because she had covered her face. Then she turned to her, by the way, and said, "Please let me come in to you," for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. So she said, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" And he said, "I will send you a young goat from the flock." And she said, "Will you give me a pledge until you send it?" So he's on his way to shear his sheep, so he doesn't have them with him. He's going to where the flocks are. He says, "Well, would a kid of the goats be adequate pay?" She says, "Sure, but you don't have one right here. How am I going to know you're going to send it back? Can you give me some collateral? Can you give me a pledge? Leave your watch or something here so that I know you're going to send the kid back to recover your collateral." That's what she's asking. She says, "Will you give me a pledge till you send it?" Then he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" So she said, "Your signet," which was his ring, with his distinctive initial or something on it that was unmistakably his. And cord, not sure what that was, possibly the cord that maybe the signet was not on a ring but on a hung around on a cord from his belt or from around his neck. And your staff that is in your hand. Again, staffs in those days were elaborate, carved, personalized walking sticks. They were not just an old stick you'd pick up walking along the way. They were very, very much a part of life in a walking society. And so these things she asked for were things that were very distinctively his and could obviously be proven to be his at a later date, which was important for her purposes. Then he gave them to her, and he went into her, and she conceived by him, though he didn't find out about that immediately. So she arose and went away and laid aside her veil and put on her garments of widowhood, went back to her father's house again, acted like nothing had happened, but now she was pregnant by her father-in-law. And Judah sent the young goat by the hand of his friend, the Adullamite, to receive his pledge from the woman's hand. That is to get back his staff and his signet, because he now was paying what he'd offered. But he did not find her. Then he asked the men of that place, saying, "Where is the harlot who is openly by the roadside?" And they said, "There's no harlot in this place." We got zoning laws against that here. And he returned to Judah and said, "I cannot find her." Also the men of the place said, "There was no harlot in this place." Then Judah said, "Well, let her take them for herself, lest we be ashamed." He didn't want to make a big deal about it. Didn't want to publicize it. Put an ad in the paper, "Looking for a harlot that I consorted with who has my signet ring." He just said, "Well, I don't want to bring shame. I'll just let it go. I can get another one. For I sent this young goat, and you have not found her." Apparently the goat was worth more in terms of money than the signet and the staff. That would normally be the case. And he figured, "Well, I offered her the money. If she wants to have the signet and the staff instead, that's okay. I made good on my offer. I offered the goat. She wasn't there. My obligation is settled." And it came to pass about 3 months after, of course, when a woman might begin to show that she's pregnant, couldn't conceal it anymore, that Judah was told, saying, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry." Now this, when it says she played the harlot, you might get the impression that they knew about this story we've just read, that she has acted like a harlot. But played the harlot simply means she's committed adultery. They didn't know that she had disguised herself literally as a harlot and had been with her father-in-law and so forth. All they knew is she was pregnant and she was living in her father's house. She had no husband and she really belonged technically to Shelah, though she hadn't been given to him yet. She was betrothed and therefore she should be put to death, they thought, because she had played the harlot, which is just a Hebraism that means she had committed immorality, she committed adultery. And she's even with child. So Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burned." Now this proves that this is a very ancient story that goes back before the time of Moses, because from Moses' time on, they'd be stoned. The method of punishing adultery in Moses' time and after was always through stoning. But here, this is a more ancient time where the custom would be that she'd be burned. Now you might think that Judah's a bit of a hypocrite here. He's the one who's the father, though he doesn't know it. But I mean, he's slept with a woman who wasn't his wife. So why is he saying she should be burned? Well, there's several reasons. Not all of them good, but there are reasons. I mean, I'm not saying they're excuses, but they are things that played into the cultural reasoning. One was he was a man, she was a woman. Now, that sounds like a pretty sexist thing to say, and it is. But that's the way it was. A man in that society could have as many women as he wanted, but a woman could have only one man. A man could have many wives, but a woman could only have one husband. Now, there's a logistical reason for that. A man would have many wives so that he could have more children that way. A woman couldn't have any more children, whether she had 10 husbands or 100 husbands. She could only carry one man's baby at a time, but many women could carry babies from the same man at the time, and therefore the increase of a family could be promoted by a man having several wives, but it could not be promoted by a woman having several husbands. Now, I'm not saying that's good or should be. I'm just saying that's the thinking of the time. That's why polygamy was sort of a double standard thing. But you see, going to a harlot or having a concubine or having many wives in that society, in that very morally darkened age, it was not considered to be that scandalous. I mean, Judah was out with his friend. You know, listen, go pay my harlot for me. You know, I mean, he's not really ashamed. He doesn't want to make a public thing of it, but because it's a little embarrassing that he got ripped off of his signet and so forth, but he apparently, in that society, it just wasn't that socially shocking for a man to have more than one woman, even if he wasn't married to her in some cases, though harlotry was not considered good. Apparently, it was not as bad for a man in that society as we, as Christians, understand it to be. It was not considered to be. Furthermore, she was married. Not officially, she was betrothed to Sheba. And therefore, since he was not the father, it's clear that she had been with another man. That made her not only a prostitute, that made her an adulteress. And you see, Judah was not married at the time. He was a widower. So even if he had committed a sin, it was the sin of fornication. Her sin was the sin of adultery. And even in the law of Moses later on, an adulteress would be put to death. A fornicator would just have to marry the person they'd been with. So it was a lesser sin. It's true, Judah, you know, was a product of times that observed double standards that we would consider to be unfair, but that it's nonetheless the fact that that was the cultural assumption, and he was a product of his times. So he didn't think himself a hypocrite, that he could go as a widower into a prostitute with impunity, but that a woman who was actually betrothed to be married to his son gets pregnant by someone else, that'd be adultery, that'd be a punishable by death crime. There was, in that day, and even later on in the days of the law, there would have been a different degree of punishment assumed worthy in both cases. Now, when she was brought out, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, "By the man to whom these belong, I am with child." And she said, "Please determine whose these are, the signet, the cord, and the staff." So, of course, she now, for the first time, lets know that she was the prostitute. She had his stuff to prove that he was the father. So Judah acknowledged them and said, "She has been more righteous than I, because I did not give her to Shelah, my son." And he never knew her again. Of course, he would not sleep with her again because she had been his son's wife, and it was an incestuous thing to sleep with your son's wife. He had done it once ignorantly. But he realized that now he has committed adultery. He didn't know it. The prostitute, he assumed, was a single woman. But now he realized he's not only committed adultery, but incest. And all of this happened because of his own failure to meet his obligations to allow Tamar the right to marry Shelah. Now, you know, this is an interesting thing because it suggests that women had rights. They didn't have much way to enforce them in those days. There wasn't probably a court of law that she could have gone to and said, "My father-in-law is depriving me of the right to be married and have children." But Judah, when pressed to the wall, realized he was wronging her. He was depriving her of her rights. She had the right to marry Shelah, and he was wrong to withhold it. So it's interesting. We sometimes think that in ancient times, people just considered women didn't have rights. People knew in their conscience that women have rights. It was just the case that society was set up in a way that women didn't get their rights enforced very often. And they often were victimized because it was a man's world. And women didn't have very many recourses to demand the rights. That's why Tamar resorted to such a stratagem. She found a way to have a baby. at the expense of her father-in-law, who was the one cheating her out of that right, she got herself a baby. And he got himself ashamed and actually realized and had to admit that she was not as guilty as he was. Now it came to pass at the time of giving birth that, behold, twins were in her womb. There were twins in the family, of course. Jacob and Esau had been twins, and now two generations later we've got twins in the family again. And so it was when she was giving birth that one put out his hand, and the midwife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying, "This one came out first." Then it happened as he drew back his hand, which is a very unusual thing to happen in a process of birth, that his brother came out unexpectedly, and she said, "How did you break through? This breach be upon you," whatever that means. Therefore his name was called Perez, which means breach. Afterward his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah. Now Zerah was the one who literally should have been the firstborn. His hand came out first. And she marked him by putting a thread on so that they'd know which one actually was the firstborn. But the hand went back in, and Perez somehow positioned himself in the place of his brother and came out first. Now, technically, Zerah was the firstborn. He was the first to have part of his body delivered, anyway, and the cord around his wrist proved that he was the firstborn. But Perez, who came out all the way first, ended up, of course, receiving the birthright. He is the one through whom Christ came. Christ came through Perez, not through Zerah, as we see in Matthew 1, verse 3. So, it's another one of those situations where God works things out so that the person who would be the natural firstborn doesn't actually end up with the birthright. It seems like generation after generation in that particular family, God was finagling it, that the one who came out first didn't get the birthright. And this, I said earlier, and I would repeat, I think is one of God's ways of illustrating that chosenness is not a basis of natural birth. God chooses people not on the basis that nature would choose them, but on the nature of basis of his own choices. Now, chapter 39, we get back to Joseph, meanwhile, back in Egypt. Now, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, the officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard and Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. Now, we were told in the last verse of chapter 37 that they were Midianites who had taken him down there. And now they are called Ishmaelites. However, there's no problem whatsoever with that. The Ishmaelites and Midianites are terms that overlap the same people. Midianites is a more specific term, a more racial term. And Ishmaelites is more of an umbrella term, sort of like the modern word Arabs. Midianites could be Ishmaelites, and so could other racial groups be Ishmaelites. And so there's no problem here. We see that all the way through the narrative, in chapter 37, they were alternately called Midianites or Ishmaelites. It was back and forth and back and forth. We see, for example, in chapter 37, verse 25, it says there was a company of Ishmaelites. And then verse 28, then the Midianite traders passed by. And in the same verse, and they sold him to the Ishmaelites. And then, of course, in the last verse of chapter 37, and the Midianites sold him. And now they're Ishmaelites again. The same people are alternately called Ishmaelites or Midianites all the way through the story. Verse 2. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man. He was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put in his hand. So it was from the time that he had made him overseer of that house and all that he had that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, and the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate, for Joseph was a handsome man in form and appearance. Same words that were used of Rachel earlier, that she was beautiful in form and appearance. Apparently, face and physique is what is meant by form and appearance. The appearance being the face and the form being the physique. Now, Joseph is a slave, but he's a competent man. This is not natural, although he might have had natural strength as well in this area, but God's blessing was on him. So whatever he did really ended up being prosperous for his master. Now, people who owned slaves were always looking for reliable, competent people among their slaves to give more responsibility to. The idea of having slaves is that they don't, you have less to do if you've got good slaves that you can trust. And if you've got unreliable slaves, you've got to, supervise them all the time yourself. But if you find a competent, honest man among them, you can give him a position as a steward over the other servants or whatever. And Joseph, by stages, apparently won the confidence of his master, largely by the blessing of God that was on him and his own honesty and competence, that eventually he was elevated to a position above all the other servants. Now, he was still a slave, but he was so trusted that his master left everything that he owned in his hand, every decision, every purchase, every sale of property, Everything. The master didn't even keep inventory himself. He trusted Joseph completely. The master didn't even know what he owned. He just knew what was put in front of him to eat. In other words, he delegated everything, all the authority of the household, to Joseph, as if Joseph was the master of the household himself. And he was, although he was a slave, a servant, under his master. In one sense, this corresponds to the way that the Father has treated Jesus, that Jesus has been given the rule over all things. Really, he's subject to his Father, the Bible says. But all things have been given into his hand. In fact, it says that in John 13:3. In John 13:3, Jesus, knowing that his Father had put all things in his hands. This was on the night of his betrayal in the upper room. So it says of Potiphar that he left all that he had in Joseph's hand. And Joseph was given full authority. Jesus said after his resurrection, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me by the Father, of course. Jesus is still subject to his Father, but God's delegated everything to him. The rule of the universe. Now, in saying Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, what we're being set up for is the next part of the story. Because he was handsome in form and appearance, Potiphar's wife cast her eyes upon him. Now, it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, lie with me. And he refused and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Now, Potiphar, of course, didn't work at home. He was the captain of the guard of Pharaoh, so he worked in the palace or somewhere like that, in the Pentagon or somewhere. And he left his home. His wife was a stay-at-home mom, or no mom, probably not a mom. I'll tell you why. Because in most cases, the high-ranking officials in places like Egypt or Babylon or places like that, they were eunuchs. They were castrated. It was part of the cost of obtaining a high office in the administration of many ancient countries that a man had to part with his masculine organs. And the reason for that was largely to keep him undistracted so that he could devote all his energies toward one thing, that is to fulfilling the duties associated with his post, and not be distracted by women, which tend to be the most distracting thing in most men's lives. And so men were castrated routinely, in many cases, to hold high offices in government. We don't know for sure if Potiphar was castrated or if he was a eunuch, but there's very good reason to think he was. You might say, well, then why was he married? Why would a eunuch be married? Hard to say. A lot of times in ancient times, a wife was merely an ornament. Just part of the whole frame of the picture, of the portrait of the man. You know, he's got a home, he's got wealth, he's got a wife, probably a beautiful wife in all likelihood. I mean, if he's a man of high standing and his wife was more of an ornament than a companion, she'd probably be picked for her ornamental value. I'm reading a bit between the lines, and it may not be all the case what I'm saying, but there's every reason to suspect that this was the case. There's no mention of Potiphar having any children, and that would be explained easily enough if he was a eunuch. It would also be explained why his wife was so sexually starved that she had to start trying to seduce servants. Now, I'm not saying that she's justified in this. It's one thing to say we can give reasons for a person's sin. It's another thing to say that those reasons really constitute an excuse. There's no excuse for sin. But that doesn't mean there are no mitigating factors that incline toward increase of temptation. The woman's temptation may have been increased by the possibility that she was married to a man who was incapable of having relations with her. Joseph, on the other hand, was good-looking, well-built, and no doubt capable. Now, what's amazing here is that Joseph was not made a eunuch, because it was customary when anyone was in contact with the harem of a king, for example, or important people, that they would be castrated, of course, just to keep things from getting out of hand. And it's interesting that Joseph had not been made a eunuch of, since he was obviously operating around other servants, probably female servants too, and even in proximity to the man's wife. Now, It would not, if Joseph had had an affair with Potiphar's wife, it would not have been the first time in history that that kind of thing happened. And Potiphar certainly knew that he had a handsome young man at home with his wife, day in and day out. And I seriously doubt that Potiphar was unaware of his wife's character either. I mean, I doubt if she kept it a total secret from her husband that she was a woman with sexual desires. And even if Potiphar was not a eunuch, and even if he and his wife had regular relations, that doesn't mean that that it's always a safe thing to have a handsome man working in the house with the wife nearby, especially as it turns out with a wife who has such low moral character. And Potiphar seems to, what I'm saying is this must reflect the high degree of trust that Potiphar had for Joseph. That he allowed Joseph to be in this position where another servant of a lesser caliber, of a lesser character, could easily take advantage. In fact, would have to be castrated to avoid him taking advantage. And customarily would have been that Joseph was not castrated. He was not made a eunuch, even though he was allowed to function in a position of authority, power, and close proximity to the owner's wife. That simply was unheard of. But the fact that Joseph, a slave, was not made to be castrated proves how much confidence his master had in his integrity. And, of course, he knew that if he did make Joseph a eunuch, that would prevent Joseph from ever being able to have a family. And apparently his master liked him and didn't want to unnecessarily prevent that. And so Joseph was left capable of doing wrong, but in his character incapable of it because he feared God. It's interesting that he rebuked her and said, "Listen, my master's treated me really well. He's kept nothing from me except you, and you're his wife. Of course he'd keep you from me, but everything else he's put in my hands." You'd expect to say, "How can I do this thing you're suggesting and sin against my master, who's been so generous toward me and so trusting of me?" But he doesn't say that. He says, "How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Even though Joseph, by the way, is far from any godly environment. I'll tell you what, it's hard even for a Christian if they're separated from all fellowship with other Christians. He didn't have a Bible. He'd never had a Bible. There weren't any Bibles. He didn't have any written word. The only word he'd ever heard from God was probably the promises made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, probably repeated out loud to the family, and also the dreams that he'd had from God. That was a revelation from God, but that was the only Bible he had, the only word from God. And that's not much. He didn't have even the Ten Commandments that say, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." He just knew instinctively that that would be wrong. And he knew that'd be a sin against God. And it shows that a man without a Bible, even in days before the indwelling of the Holy Spirit to enable him, he didn't even have the grace that is available to Christians. And he was in an environment totally corrupt without a single godly person to encourage him in godliness. And there, as far as he knew, for the rest of his life. And in a house with a woman who, as near as he could tell, was going to pester him for the rest of his life. You know, the devil, if you get tempted to do something wrong, and you're in the heat of temptation, one of the things the devil definitely is going to say to you is that you'll never get over this temptation unless you just give in. I mean, somehow the lie occurs to you that the only way out is to succumb. That if you don't succumb, you'll just perpetually for the rest of your life be bombarded with this temptation, never a bit of relief. Of course, that's not true. If you resist temptation, eventually the devil has to lay off for a while and you'll have relief. But the devil doesn't want you to know that. He wants you to think that, hey, do you like this? Do you like this pressure? It's going to keep up. And it's going to keep up and keep up and keep up forever until you give in. Well, of course, when the devil tells us that, that's a lie. Although he often obtains his object by lying to us in that way, deceiving us. What's interesting is if the devil said it's Joseph, it would seem very true. He was a slave in that house for life. Every day of his life he had to be around this woman. And every day of his life she tried to seduce him. I mean, it makes it all the harder to resist when you say, well, I might be able to resist now, but can I do this for 6 months, 6 years, 10 years, this woman on me all the time? Am I going to be able every day of the rest of my life to resist this continual bombardment? I'll tell you, it's enough to make a guy wonder whether he ought to just give in. But he didn't. And what's more, there is every reason to believe that he could have gotten away with it, that it'd be secret. In fact, he was more endangered by not doing it because he could make her angry and she could falsely accuse him. This is, of course, what eventually happened. He'd be safer if he went ahead and succumbed. I mean, all these things were against him. All of these things were part of the temptation that came to him. And yet, he resisted it heroically. And the reason I make all these points is because Christians who succumb to such temptation do so under much less pressure, with much less justification, with much more resources from God to prevent it. And yet, I know very few Christian men who are quite as heroic in resisting temptation as this man was. Now, you might say, well, I've remained pure. Wonderful. Have you ever been in a situation like Joseph was in? Have you ever had a beautiful woman try to drag you physically into bed, whom you could not just change your job? I worked for a woman once as a window cleaner. I was mainly self-employed all my single life as a window cleaner as I support myself in ministry. But when I moved to a new area once, I didn't have any accounts, and this woman was advertising. She had a janitorial service and wanted a window cleaner, so I let her hire me. And she was not an unattractive woman, and she was apparently single. I didn't ask too much about her private life because she was very flirtatious. And I eventually just quit the job because I felt like, I don't need this, you know. I don't need this kind of flirtation on a daily basis from an attractive woman. I was a single guy, and I just didn't need that. So I quit my job, as I'm sure Christians many times in history have done. They've had to quit their jobs because of the special temptations there. Joseph couldn't quit. He was a slave. He was owned. He couldn't leave. I dare say that Joseph was in an extremely intense situation of temptation that he could not escape from legitimately and without any spiritual resources except his own integrity. And yet, he did very well. It says, it was so, verse 10, so it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time, when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand, and he fled and ran outside. And so it was, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, that she called to the men of the house and spoke to them, saying, see, he has brought to us a Hebrew to mock us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened when he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside. Now, if this had really happened the way she said, she was doing the right thing. Quickly, call the servants, report it. You know, there's a lot of women who report that they've been sexually harassed at their job 20 years ago. Never mentioned it until now. You know, I mean, you know there's been a lot of cases in news lately because of one of the chief justices of the Supreme Court being probably falsely accused of sexual harassment by a former woman associate that he had formerly worked with. But, you know, there's been a lot of talk about sexual harassment in the workplace. And what has generally been discovered is that the best thing a woman can do if she experiences it is quickly, immediately, tell someone about it. So that even if nothing is done about it till later, she can testify, I told someone at the time. Rather than have someone who's inquiring of her say, and who doubts her story say, why didn't you mention it for 10 years? This woman, claiming sexual harassment from Joseph, called witnesses in immediately. Of course, they weren't witnesses of the event, but they could see that she had his coat in her hand, and therefore it seemed to give credence to her story to a certain extent. So Joseph was looking pretty bad and in trouble. Of course, this was just the kind of thing that a slave could be put to death for. So she kept his garment with her until his master came home. Then she spoke with him with words like these, saying, the Hebrew servant whom you brought to us came in to mock me. So it happened, meaning to insult me by seeking to force himself upon me. So it happened, as I lifted up my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me and fled outside. So it was, when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, your servant did to me after this manner, that his anger was aroused. Then Joseph's master took him and put him into prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. Now, it says Potiphar's anger was aroused. Notice it doesn't say his anger was aroused toward Joseph. You might say, well, that's implied. I mean, he put Joseph in prison. He must have been mad at Joseph. I don't think so. If he really believed his wife's story, he'd kill Joseph. A man, even a free man, could be put to death for committing adultery or for trying to rape a woman. But if that man who did so happened to be a slave who didn't even have the right to life and could be, for lesser crimes than this, put to death by his master, the kind of anger a man feels toward a man who tries to rape his wife, being such, if Potiphar was angry at Joseph, he would have killed him. It's almost certain. Instead, he put him in jail. Now, you might say, well, what? You're saying Potiphar didn't believe his wife's story? I don't think he did. He knew Joseph well. He knew Joseph's character, which is why he trusted him around his wife in the first place. He also knew his wife, I imagine, well enough to know what kind of woman she was. I mean, this kind of behavior doesn't happen in a vacuum. A woman who's ordinarily very honest and meek and sweet and righteous and always tells the truth doesn't all of a sudden do the kind of thing this woman did, try to rape a man and then lie about it and try to get him in trouble, try to get him killed for not cooperating with her. I mean, good women don't do this kind of thing. And therefore, Potiphar, knowing his wife as well as any man should know a wife, would know that he's not dealing with a woman of extremely high character here. He might not know that she would, until now, know that she would resort to this kind of a thing. But the woman must have been a woman who was perceptibly of low character. Joseph was a man of obviously high character. And as I say, I suspect that the anger of Potiphar was not directed toward Joseph, or else he would have had more exquisite ways of taking out his wrath on the man than just throw him into a country club jail where the king's prisoners go. Of course, it wasn't a country club jail like we have today, but even in our society, political prisoners and people who are wealthy who go to jail usually go to fancier, more comfortable jails than the ordinary scumbags, you know, who get convicted of the same crimes. I think Potiphar was angry because he knew his wife was lying, but he knew also that he couldn't ignore. It would be socially unheard of for a man to call his wife a liar and to side with a slave against his own wife. Just couldn't happen. He had to act on her accusation. He obviously acted very mildly upon it and just put Joseph in prison. A very mild punishment if Joseph had really been guilty of what he was charged. I think the anger of Potiphar is that he realized that his wife had now put him, Potiphar, in the uncomfortable position to have to get rid of Joseph, even though it was very profitable for him to keep Joseph. Joseph was probably his friend and very well trusted and very well admired for his integrity and also very profitable. Very convenient to have Joseph in that position. And all of that was over now because of his wife's accusations. He couldn't ignore them altogether. He had to do something. And so Joseph what appears to be a token punishment, just so that it could not be said that he did nothing about his wife's accusations. He put him in jail. That is how I read this. And it says in verse 21, but the Lord was with Joseph, even in jail. The Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's hand because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper. You may notice that there is a verbal parallel between verses 21 and 23 on the one hand and verses 2 through 4 on the other. Notice in verse 2, when Joseph was sold into Potiphar's house, the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man. In verse 21, in the prison, the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor. And in the case of Joseph in verse 3, it says the Lord had made all that he did to prosper in his hand. It says that in verse 23 also in the prison, that the Lord was with him and whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper. In verse 4, it said of him in Potiphar's house, then Potiphar made him overseer over his house, and all that he had he put in his hand. So did the keeper of the prison, the same thing in verse 22. He committed into Joseph's hand all the prisoners. There's a parallel here. Wherever Joseph goes, there's a pattern. And this pattern is, in a sense, a precursor or an omen of a positive sort, that God's dreams that he gave Joseph are likely to come true. That is, God had told Joseph he was going to have superiority over his brothers, that he was going to rise to the top of the family in priority. Well, that was certainly far from happening here in Egypt. As a slave in Potiphar's house or in prison, it didn't seem very likely that he'd ever see his brothers again, much less have them bow down to him. But everywhere he went, there was sort of a reminder that God was able to do this, because although he had not risen to priority over his brothers, he rose immediately to priority over all the servants, and they, as it were, bowed down to him. Probably not literally, but they submitted to him. Likewise, when he was later put in jail, all the prisoners were put under his hand. He was given authority over all of them. That God's blessing on him was, he was a man who just couldn't help but rise to the top. And it wasn't that he was ambitious to do so. He just, God's blessing was on him. Wherever he went, he prospered. And this was sort of God's way of sort of foreshadowing the fact that his prosperity, even over his brothers, was going to be a reality, even as God had promised through dreams. Of course, this pattern of Joseph becoming the best in the domain that he is in, whether it's in the household of Potiphar or in the prison, is going to happen in the whole land of Egypt, because he's now going to rise, or shortly after this, going to rise to the top of even that domain. And all things are going to be put in his hand by Pharaoh also. And it will be that will bring the fulfillment of the promises of his brothers bowing down to him at a later point. We will have to stop at this point, however. And that's not too good, because we are planning on only having two more sessions. And we have 11 chapters to cover. But the story moves much more rapidly up to this point. But that still makes it a tight squeeze. We might need three sessions. We'll see. Anyway, we'll close with that. We have a few minutes left of this session, but not enough to really get into the next chapter. So we'll stop there and end the session early.